Welcome everybody to another episode of the Rule Not the Exception podcast. We have one of Britain's rising stars sitting opposite us today. We have the wonderful Anjali Mahindra.
Hello.
Thank you for coming onto the podcast.
Thanks for having me. This is cool.
It's a pleasure. I know you've been a guest that we've been wanting to get on for a while, and I'm so glad we were able to make it happen.
Yeah, me too.
I guess first thing I want to know is how's your 2020 been? It's been such a crazy year, and how have you navigated it yourself? Has there been ups and downs? What's it been like?
It's been interesting. I feel like my answer to that question has changed so much just during like the past sort of 6 months. Really early on, I quite enjoyed it. I quite enjoyed the lockdown element. I just enjoyed having space and time to like figure out what I wanted to do, what kind of artist I wanted to be, whether I still wanted to do it. I just enjoyed the space a lot. And then I actually lost somebody to COVID recently, my nanny ma, last week. And so all of the optimism that I had is sort of like flipped on its head for a minute. And it suddenly becomes really like a real thing, this whole thing, if that makes sense. Because at one point it was like a virus over there that was causing when I say over there, I mean like figuratively speaking, it's like not something that affects you directly. But then now it has. And it's just like, I feel like my alarm's going to go off in a minute and we're all going to wake up and this is just going to be one really long group dream that we all had. But it's so strange, isn't it? It's so strange. How has it been for you guys?
Yeah, I think similar. I think the interesting thing about it is that so many people will be like, I'll have friends who work in the city or just work full-time jobs. Like, oh my God, don't know what to do in my day. Like my schedule's gone, my routine's gone. And they're like, how's it been for you? I was like, yeah, as an actor, this isn't too dissimilar from what we've had to experience.
Yeah.
So from that perspective, it's been okay.
Yeah.
I feel like as time has gone on, you have waves of ups and downs with it. How's it been for you?
I really liked lockdown. Probably forced to like it, I think, because I guess I'm quite 0 to 100. So it was similarly to you. I felt like it was quite nice to have a bit of space because usually I'm just dipping my fingers into all the pies and trying to find out what to do next. And if I'm not keeping busy, I'll make sure I am. So actually, all of a sudden, your social life's sort of taken away from you. So there's all that time on your own. I got a cat.
Oh my God.
Which I've trained to high five and
play
fetch. So,
what's your cat called?
It's called Remy.
Oh my God, that's so cute.
He's very cute. But yeah, similarly to you, I think as time goes on and you start to know people that have lost people to it,
yeah,
it suddenly does become a lot closer and nearer.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you suddenly realize you've not been out of the country for a while, or you haven't worked the way you normally would for a while, you haven't seen your family for a while. So, yeah.
I'm sorry to hear that you lost your nanny ma. Do you almost feel like is it one of those moments that things fall into perspective?
Oh, hugely. Really, really, in a big way. It's weird grief, isn't it? Because you're going through it and at the same time you're kind of doing everything to avoid going through it. So you kind of tune in and out of it. It definitely has put stuff into perspective. And it makes me, there's a lot of like COVID naysayers about, like COVID deniers about, who I have encountered a few, and just been able to take it with a pinch of salt. But now I think I have a very different like standpoint on it because, yeah, it just hits you differently, I guess, when you know it's real. And when you lose people who you ordinarily wouldn't have lost yet, you know, you kind of go, this is something that is prematurely taking what could be longer lives. It's bizarre. But yeah, things go into perspective. I feel like even just COVID in general, not so much it hitting personally, but it has. I feel like it made me go, is the pleasure that I get from getting a job and acting, is it enough? And is it sustainable? And how long does it last? And does it really matter? I don't know. It's been a real like year for processing.
What were some of the answers to that?
That it doesn't matter. And what is the end goal? For me, it used to be like getting an Oscar or being in like being the lead in a huge like feature film that makes it in cinema. And I get to play like an incredibly flawed and complex character, and that still is exciting, but it's not what happens when I get there. I wonder what I'll want then. It feels like a bit like the dangling carrot that we're just never gonna quite get it.
You said something interesting a few minutes ago, that you weren't sure if you wanted to do it anymore.
Yeah.
Is that acting or just industry in general?
I think it was acting.
I'd love to know why and what it is that brought you to that mindset.
I love it so much. I just don't know if I always love it. And I think sometimes, I guess really early on, I was like, if I was to take a percentage of how much enjoyment I have versus how much like the rejection and the speed of being on set can sometimes rob you of the enjoyment. I was just, because I'm a bit of a maths head, I was like trying to work out like, do it in percentages and try and work out sort of what my future plan was that way. The thing is, I think if you are an actor, I just don't know if you can ever really stop being an actor. I think it's just a part of you, like the desire to tell stories and entertain and get lost in a world. I don't know if that is something you can just tap in and out.
Do you feel like the enjoyment factor of it, however small the percentage, is something that you would miss if you did?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Have you guys ever had that weird wobble?
I mean, I think I have mine quarterly.
Quarter daily.
I think similarly to you sound like you're quite analytical. And
yes,
so I think
hugely.
I will probably do the same thing where I'll go, does the stress and the uncertainty and then being female and wanting other things as well, or being really aware of, we've got a biological clock and all this sort of stuff that starts playing in. I wonder whether that starts to really, you know, catch up with you as you get older and you've been in this industry for longer, whether with each rejection you start to weigh up, well, does that outweigh the times you do get the job?
Yeah.
And not unfortunately, but every time you do, it sort of does. You just,
oh my God, the minute you're about to give up, it's like something happens almost.
So I think, I don't know any actor that doesn't go through it. I think SAG's quite good at just kind of going, well, it's just part of the game.
I think, I think there is the ups and the downs. Like, I've been through super downs with it because I did leave the industry for a short while.
Yeah,
for like,
so you were telling me this.
6 months, I went and got a proper job, and it just wasn't what I wanted, and I felt like I had to do it because I felt like the industry was rejecting me.
Right.
So you sort of feel a sense of, well, if they don't want me, why don't I go and try and find somewhere that
does? Yes, I know that feeling totally.
and you sort of go, all right, well, I'm gonna set up this new life and I'm going to go and work in the city. And I worked for like this marketing department for a company, and you're working for these clients who you care zero about. When you've worked for yourself for so long, to put that energy into a client, I think it was for like some ferry company and some airline company. And I was like, I really don't care.
Yeah.
It's really difficult to get out of that mindset when you've worked on you for so long to put it onto something else. And I think I realized pretty quickly that I don't think I could do this. So it was tough, but alas, we're all here.
We're still working.
But you've branched out a bit and doing writing and maybe a bit of producing?
Yeah, mainly bits of writing. I did the Royal Court Writers Programme a couple of years ago. Really loved it. And then, I don't know, I always need a bit of a run-up. I'm a real procrastinator. Like, the tidiest you'll find my house is when I've got some sort of deadline, because I just can't. I need a lot of faff to get myself into it. It's really annoying. It's so annoying for my boyfriend. So I just kind of kept using the excuse of having auditions to like, oh, well, never mind. I'll never get that draft finished because I keep getting these last minute auditions come through. So yeah, I guess lockdown removed all of that, and I had to sit with myself and had an opportunity to write something that would get made. That's quite rare, isn't it? That you write something that is a guaranteed product. Not a huge product, it was just going to be a recorded thing put on YouTube.
So you were commissioned prior to writing it?
Not commissioned, it was this sort of like scheme that an actor friend of my boyfriend, her name's Danusha, she's amazing, she's mega talented, and had set up this scheme called Virtual Collaborators, where she'd got actors, directors and writers together and created little triangles of like one of each to just go off and make a monologue, make a piece that would be recorded. So you knew that you were going to have an actor to work with. I knew that I was going to have a director to work with, and therefore the momentum of them kind of expecting a result, expecting drafts. That's quite nice, because it's like you have to. And also it's going to get made, even if one person sees it, even if just they saw it. Like it's going to come to fruition.
Did the creative process feel different? Because was it all done via Zoom and things like that? Was that different?
I've got nothing to compare it to, because apart from the Royal Court Writers thing, I hadn't ever written anything. So I think I've been quite spoiled. It's made subsequent writing harder, because I'm a bit like, anyone free to read it? Anyone like, yeah, and then I keep having doubt, which is it's harder to have doubt when there's three people sort of like bouncing the ball back to each other.
Did you enjoy the process?
I loved it. Really loved it. Really, really loved it. It's fed into my acting a bit because I like to know what the answer is now, and I want the answer right away. But with that, there was just four or five Zoom sessions where we just spoke about our feelings about lockdown and COVID. And then the idea just came to fruition. So now I kind of stolen that for acting, where I'm like, I don't have to know who the character is in an hour or 2 hours within that time of having a script. It can just be little things you think about over a period of time, and then it sort of evolves that way. Just trusting the process, I guess.
Was that your first bit of writing, or have you dabbled into it before?
I think it's 2016 when I wrote a play and submitted it to the court. Mm-hmm. Before then, no, I'd not written. I'd written stuff myself,
yeah,
but never really put it anywhere or did anything with it.
How would you describe yourself as a writer? Are you someone who likes to like get the structure down, or are you sort of like scene to scene and then piece it together?
I did just used to love running away with it. So I just like start in a cafe with two people talking, and before you know it, they've like decided to go and rob a bank or whatever. And it's just like I catch myself off guard with where it's going, which is quite nice sometimes. But the latest thing I'm working on, I wrote this script for this pilot and sent it to people and they loved it. But one person was like, it's great, but to be able to work on it, she's a brilliant script editor called Jess. And she said, to be able to work on it, we need to take it back to beat sheet stage so that you can start rearranging it. And thus was born my discovery of beat sheets and pitches and treatments and all this stuff that I just didn't even know about.
Does it give you, similarly, you saying that the idea of character has fed into acting, like seeing the beat sheets and from concept to beats to scenes to, you know, the whole story, does that make you look at a script differently now when you get an audition in or when you work on projects?
Yeah. No, this is going to sound really daft, but it makes me go, God, I knew writers were smart and intelligent, but like my respect for them and the observation time that I give a script has like increased tenfold, because you're like, nothing has just happened by chance. And I think I took that for granted a bit. I thought like, oh, here I am, the smart one who's going to imbue this all right script with my genius. But actually like it's all there. You just have to mine it. And as an actor, I mean, taking a script that's already written. But yeah, it certainly has. I know that you both write a bit. Did that happen with you? I imagine it's...
I think I did the former, which was I would sit and just write and run away with something.
Mm.
I would then send it to Amrita and she'd tear it apart.
good at that.
Which was both great and horrible for my ego. But it was helpful. And then I found myself just learning to focus in more on structure, which I'm probably still not great at, but you find a way to go, okay, what's happening here? Where does that go? Where's that next? Where do we get to by this point? Just from listening to other filmmakers and writers who would talk so much about watching films, for example, and noticing that at like, I don't know, minute 25 or at minute 35, this would happen in most structures. So I'd sort of pay attention to that. So I sort of, yeah, I think that was the general process for us. And then, you know, we got very lucky to get representation. So that was another layer of feedback, which always helps. So it wasn't too bad.
Yeah, it's odd though, because I don't know about you guys, but the feedback you get on writing never feels as bad if it's bad feedback as it does when you're an actor. It's really bizarre.
Someone said that's because you're the paint, the canvas, yeah, the artist, you're all of it. But yeah, when you're writing something, it's like, yeah, it's not completely,
you can kind of take it really constructively as a writer, I think, whereas as an actor you're like, oh my god, I'm terrible, I should never do this.
Yeah.
So you seem quite disciplined in that sense. Were you quite good during lockdown to sit down and go, I'm going to do this?
I discovered that my coping mechanism is to throw myself into stuff. So if I feel anxious, or which I do suffer from anxiety and depression, but have a handle on both of those things, but I realised that the coping mechanism that came out of dealing with those two things like a handful of years ago is to just be super busy. So yeah, it became a bit of a running joke in the flat with my fella, because it was just like we were busier in the first 6 weeks of lockdown than we ever are normally. And it took both of us to identify it in the other person and go, why am I not seeing you? There's nowhere to go. We're in the same flat, but you're in your study and I'm in mine and we're just not hanging out. And yeah, I think then we both realised that that's our way of just coping. It's our way of feeling like of having control. And we weren't making, like, You're probably going to ask what it was we were doing, but to be honest, I don't really know. I love reading acting books. I love it. I absolutely love it. I think it bleeds into directing and writing as well, if you can just understand an actor in a character's mind more and more and more. So I was reading a lot and tweaking old things I'd written, watching stuff. I really was disciplined with creating distraction, I think.
Do you need routine on a daily basis?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. But I'm a control freak, definitely. And well, I like to know what I'm doing when.
I hope you'll forgive the segue.
Yes.
I wonder.
Love a segue.
If that comes from being at an armed forces school?
Maybe. I don't know. Yeah, possibly.
Okay.
Or moving around a bit, I think, because of my dad's job, maybe that might have made me need to kind of control my bit of territory, maybe. Yeah. Yeah, that was strange.
That's such a brilliant word. I've never heard somebody use the word territory or
really
a space.
It's good, isn't it? Yeah. Maybe that's an army thing as well.
Could be, but I don't know. That's quite. I'd love to know more about how that experience was, and similarly to you, I moved around a lot. And how do you feel that's kind of affected you growing up or as a person? Because you do become quite kind of, I don't know about you, but like you want things under control. You want to know what's happening next, and everything has to be quite set in your way. So how has it, I guess, influenced you growing up and also being in a career that isn't so predictable?
I think it's made me need to like to plan and to know things. The industry thing makes me shut out friends quite quickly, or like just be a bit rubbish with social stuff, because I just get so panicky about, like, you know when you get an audition and it's like for the next day and you've just got to completely cancel all your plans. I hate doing that, so I just don't make plans as much. But then the forces, British forces, like moving around quite a bit has made me very good at just jumping in and being able to make any awkward room or conversation not so awkward. You just fill the silences and you know how to sort of like, just very adaptable. But I think in a way that made me really stress out, because I felt like I was losing my identity a bit. There wasn't room to take a moment and figure stuff out, because I was just so used to adapting and becoming what other people needed you to become to make that possible and comfortable for everyone. So it's weird, really.
Did lockdown sort of make you sit with yourself a bit more?
When I finally stopped giving myself ridiculous tasks to do, yeah, definitely. Yeah, and just sort of self-analyse a bit.
Was there anything that surprised you, like in qualities in yourself or the way you are or what you like that maybe you thought you didn't?
Yeah, I tapped back into making stuff physically, like painting and creating stuff. I know we all bought loads of arts and crafts, but I just got hours pass and my tongue will be hanging out my mouth because I'm just like really enjoying it, like a little 5-year-old drawing. I don't know. Something really nice about just making a bit of paper mache or... yeah, creating shit that just goes in the bin or like sits in a drawer, but it was fun to do for a few hours.
I swear you two are one and the same.
Do you do that as
well? Maybe, yeah. yeah, I funnily enough also rediscovered painting.
Did you?
Or drawing, which is what I used to do.
What sort of painting?
Oils, mainly.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
They're scary oils.
I love oils. No, they're not scary. You can just carry on and adding on and adding on and adding on and layer it up. Start again.
Is it considered a harder form of painting?
I have no idea.
I think it is. No, I think it's like, yeah, we weren't trusted with oils in my
house. I just like the smell of it. I think that's how I got into it, because it smells so intoxicating. Smells like you're a real artist, you know.
Would you find yourself painting anything in particular, or just anything and everything?
I always find myself like trying to make stuff that's useful. So if I'm painting something, I can't allow myself just to paint an apple, because I'd be like, no, what will go in that bathroom? What colours? What will that person like? Or like, it's annoying because sometimes you should just do it for the sake of it. But I think I always try to then make it useful. It's really weird.
So I feel like we should. I feel like we're going so off on tangent on things. But
I'm really enjoying the tangents.
I'm an art podcast.
I think for anyone that isn't aware of Anjali's career, she's done a wide range of work. More recently, that you may have seen her in things like The Bodyguard, Dark Hearts, Wild Bill. How do you feel like, sounds like a really general, vague question, but when you get a chance to sit back and think about your career at the moment, how do you think about it? Good, bad, could be better, the best it can be, best it's been.
God, definitely could be better, but I feel like I don't I don't mind so much where it goes anymore. But I don't know. It's weird, isn't it? I have just finished a job and have a couple of weeks on something coming up. And so I'm in the privileged position of being in work, and therefore I can, I'll listen back to this when I'm not working and be like, God, you're such an idiot. You were so, because I think sometimes, like, even though you feel really zen, it's because of the conditions around you. But then, like, right now, I would say I don't mind being out of work because we've all just done it for a long period of time. Like, financially, that's a different thing. But I mean, mentally, I could cope. But I have the privilege of going into a short job shortly. So I don't know if I'd have a different answer to that question if I wasn't working. That's just me being really honest. But I'd like to believe that I care less. But just because of this year and realizing there are other things that make me as happy.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think a lot of people have said that, both guests and sort of my friends outside of acting even, that I think especially in London, people seem to be caught up in work quite a bit, whatever industry they're in.
Yeah, we are.
So that kind of notion of, oh, there's other stuff that makes me happy, which is kind of obvious when you think about it.
Yeah.
But I suppose there is so much pressure on work and productivity, which sounds like it's quite a big thing for you as well.
Yes, yes.
And doing something, being a doer. But what have you found does make you happy, aside from paper mache?
I do genuinely really like writing, and it's not just as it used to be as a vehicle for my acting. Mm-hmm. It was like, oh, I'll just make myself a part. I'll be the next Fleabag, and then it'll all be great. But it's more just, I'm finding myself enjoying writing stuff that has nothing to do with me or that I would necessarily be able to play and use as a platform. And I think that's because the good bits of why I love acting are still present, with just a tiny bit more of being able to be autonomous and somewhat, obviously you need someone to want to make the thing, but you're in control to a degree. I don't know. I think writing.
When you're writing, because I know earlier you said, you know, once you're an actor, you're always an actor, you always want to tell stories. And I guess that segues really well into writing. But what kind of stories do you write or do you want to tell, or do you find yourself scribbling down on paper?
The stuff about identity, I think, because I feel like I've had a really weird journey with identity and wanting so desperately to fit in and wanting to, like, literally purge my own racial identity out of myself to become this ideal in my head. And then, like, falling in love with my ethnic background and everything that makes me who I am ethnically, and then trying to, like, atone for all the years of of wanting to be white. I genuinely wanted to be white, and I found myself trying really hard to swat up on the things that I would know if I had white parents, as in, like, music, like, really trying to get into music for enjoyment purposes, but also to be like, yeah, I don't know what it is. I don't know why I felt like being Indian wasn't, I don't know, I can't, I'm still, it's something I'm still trying to process, but it's like I felt, I must have had a bad experience really young that made me feel like being Indian was wrong in some way, and being white was more superior. I just feel really sad that happened, and I'm trying to, like, process why that happened and also really embrace feeling a little bit displaced sometimes, feeling not quite Indian and not quite British, but somewhere in the middle.
What was the community like that you grew up in? Was it multicultural? Was
it was. Yeah, okay. I think it might have been the British Forces school part. And I don't think it's anybody did anything awful. I think that the school I went to was full of people who had moved around a lot of army bases around Europe. There was, like, one in Cyprus, there's many in Germany, and a couple dotted around elsewhere, where you were just surrounded by British Forces kids, and there weren't a lot of ethnic minority British Forces workers. So for ages, actually, my memory was wrong. I thought I was the only ethnic minority. There was a black girl at my school as well. But people would ask me things like, are you black? Or sort of like, someone asked me if I understood what a holiday home was once. And I was like, yeah, of course I know what a holiday home is. But it's just, I think it's just their lack of exposure to people that could have our skin colour, but also identify as English.
Do you feel like you had any role models that looked like you
growing
up?
No, I don't know if I did. Connie Hook on Blue Peter. But as in actors or people that I felt like I could really, really relate to, not so much, no. There's loads more now, but yeah.
How old were you when you were at the Armed Forces School?
I was 8 and then 12 when I left. So I think quite a formative, like, identity-forming age, maybe.
Are you aware of skin colour at that point?
Yeah, definitely. And I think because I'd gone to a school where there were loads of ethnic minority children before that, I think I really noticed the sharp jump in my sort of like surroundings.
And was it after that you came to Nottingham?
Yeah, so I'd actually lived in Nottingham, went to primary school there, moved to Germany, and then came back and went to a secondary school in Nottingham with some of the same people from primary school, but loads of new people too.
And secondary school can be both a positive and a negative experience. Was that quite a change for you to come back? How did it feel? Because it's such a strange age, you know?
Yeah, it was really weird. At the school I went to in Germany, there weren't really like tribes, as in because everybody moved around so much, nobody could really establish themselves as a school bully or like the popular girls or whatever. It was just quite like an open level playing field. Then when I came back to secondary school in Nottingham, there were genuinely like very obvious Jane Norman bag carrying sort of mean girls who I became one of them for a bit. They were quite clearly the grebs who wore like, I don't know, not prayer beads, but like Asian-y beads on their hands and like listened to Metallica or whatever. It was just definitely different groups, but I didn't know where I fit. So I kind of tried each one out a little bit. And maybe that's where the acting started to happen a little bit for me. But I stood up to the school bully without knowing it was the school bully because she was quite a bit shorter, but like quite terrifying. I didn't see that. So I...
Was she giving you grief? Is that why?
She shouted, "Move!" to everybody as she walked past them in IT. It's my first day in IT. And then she went, "Move!" to me. And I went, "No, you move!" And I just felt everybody in the classroom go, and I looked around and kind of realised that I'd done something wrong, but I didn't know what it was. So she pushed me quite hard. And then I pushed her back also quite hard. And the gasps got louder. And then someone just turned to me and went, "Run!" And I don't know why, it was the terror in her eyes that just made me go, "This is probably not great." So I ran to the toilets. And Hannah, her name was, she came and met me, and then she was like, "Do you know who that was?" I'm not going to say the name, but it was someone who everybody in school was terrified of. So I hid in the toilets for the rest of the day because I just, knowing that now this was the school bully that everyone was terrified of, made me really scared. But after that, I was really cool.
I was like, going to say that she, probably brought a lot of respect.
She sort of like passed me and was just like always like sort of gave me that chin jerk of like respect, and nobody really there was like a rumor that went around that you don't mess with Ange, she's hard.
And the rumor mill, she killed someone one time. Like,
all that kicks off.
Well, do you know what's happened to that bully now? Do you know where she's now?
She's still lives in Nottingham, I think. I don't know. Oh, God, not to psychoanalyze her, but I think she had a lot of stuff going on at home. She'd moved around schools quite a bit. She was quite unsettled. You know, she was looking like her frustrations with her sort of upbringing manifested itself in not being particularly pleasant to people who looked like they were having a nicer time. I don't know. I feel for her a lot. And we did become friends later on in life, a bit, you know, like we hung out a bit on the park and stuff. So, yeah, it's just weird. School is so weird because you feel like whatever role you have at school is who you are going to be forever. But yeah, it was strange.
Did you enjoy school though?
I loved it. I loved school. I hated being off. Like if you were poorly or whatever, I'd just hated it. I loved school so much. I was so sad when I just loved organized, like fun. I thought I really loved it.
And did you go, you didn't go to drama school?
No, we didn't.
Okay. So did you feel at that point you wanted to? Was there any temptation? Because I know personally sometimes I still battle with, I didn't go, but I sometimes think what could have been. So is it something that ever crosses your mind?
Yeah, definitely. I trained at a place called the Television Workshop in Nottingham, which isn't a drama school, but it started off as a casting pool for Carlton Studios. It used to be there and used to make a lot of TV shows for ITV. And then the studio shut down, but the drama group sort of stayed on and has kind of, like, kicked off the careers of some really great actors. I loved going, but it was kind of instinct-based training rather than theory. And as an analytical brain, someone who really likes school, I felt like I'd not done enough of that Stanislavski, Grotowski sort of, like, world. So I tried to, like, supplement that by just reading loads. It all kind of comes full circle because all of those kind of gods of acting just tell you to sort of listen and trust yourself, and it all goes back to the same place. But it's just nice doing that journey.
Yeah,
you feel like you could trust it a bit more.
So I came across your work, and I know I've spoken to you about this already, in an episode of Beaver Falls.
I couldn't believe you'd seen that.
I actually loved it. So what had happened was, so you talk about full circle, this is quite interesting. So I had left the industry and then I came back into it, and I think that show had just started on the telly, And I know friends who had gone in for it and stuff, because they were like, Sag, did you go in? I was like, no, I'm out of the game. And so it came on and I watched the series. I'm a big Arshar Ali fan. I've always liked Arshar.
He's great.
Yeah. He's sort of like just a, he's just an actor that just goes under the radar, but is always solid. And so I watched the show and I was like, oh, I don't know this girl. This is a new girl. I've never seen her before. And how were those sort of early days? I know you did Sarah Jane Adventures before that and everything, but how were those early days in terms of, I'm curious to know about castings. Were you seeing a lot of girls that looked like you at that point, or were you going up against white girls, black girls? What was the early processes like?
I think I'd say most auditions were for parts that they'd already decided were going to be Indian. But I guess because I was about 19, I was 17 when I started doing Sarah Jane Adventures, and so probably about 18, 19 when auditioning for Beaver Falls from memory. But there, I guess most people would have been going down the traditional drama school route, so there weren't a lot of people my age that were just like trying to make a go of it. So it felt like the casting pool was smaller at that point. But yeah, it's mad how much things have changed now, isn't it? Like, yeah.
I think I read somewhere that you mentioned you were encouraged to put white as your ethnicity by an agent.
Yeah.
I assume you don't do that anymore.
No.
But, I mean, number one, how did that make you feel? Were you like, yeah, okay, cool?
I was so game. I was just like, cool, yeah, that makes sense. Definitely. Yeah, I guess I just knew that it would potentially open up more. And I don't think the agent at the time was doing it from a bad place at all. I think we both had a common goal, which was to get me into more rooms.
Yeah. Coming off of that, when did you start, because you mentioned that you now really love your roots, your ethnicity, and falling back in love with it. When did that start? How was that journey from I want to be white and you know, have that ideal to suddenly going, no, I'm really cool with who I am?
I don't know what started it. I don't know what set it off. I think going to India in sort of like my late teens and just embracing it that bit more, picking up the language. I could always understand a lot of Hindi and Punjabi because I grew up with my family talking it, but they accepted an English response. I never really learned to speak it properly. But I went and spent about 6 weeks in India with my mum when I was 18. And I think that's when I slowly started to fall in love with it.
What did you love about it?
I don't know. It's like a mad Disney-like concept. It's beautiful. So culturally rich, but also there's just so much poverty and so much like corruption in parts of it as well, that like it's beautiful and sad and a little bit scary. But it just felt like home in a weird way. Though I would admit I get strange looks when I go, even if I try to wear like a salwar kameez or whatever, because the way we carry ourselves here is just different. So people still kind of treat you like you're a bit of an outsider, but it's not, I don't know, not that people treat you like you're an outsider here, but you're still aware that you don't quite come from there. I don't know, it's strange. It's a strange thing.
It's that thing of, you go there and they don't quite accept you, and here you feel like sometimes they don't quite accept you and you're sort of in
sometimes.
The middle, isn't it?
Yeah.
Maybe that's, you know, you're talking about identity before, maybe it's just that between the two that you were sitting between. And then I guess after that, you were still picking up work. You were, you know, you were getting telework and getting some stage work, and I remember seeing you in Behind the Beautiful Forevers and things like that. And, you know, so things were ticking along. Did you at that point sort of feel like, you know, my career's doing okay, and, you know, the trajectory of it, were you happy with it at that point?
Yeah, definitely. I felt like not having gone to drama school, it was hard to get into like London theatre. Regional theatres accepted me a bit more, but I found it difficult to prove that I had stagecraft. We did do theatre shows at the Nottingham Workshop, but once I'd managed to get my foot in the door at the National Theatre, opportunities started opening up, and I felt like, oh, now I feel like I've just come out of drama school and I've got a bit more opening up opportunity-wise, and I felt like I was happy to be in that place and love that play and made some really great friends. Loads of Asian friends as well, which I didn't have a lot of South Asian friends. So that was probably another like huge turning point. When you meet people you relate to who have a similar background to you, it's, I don't know, something about feeling seen and that shared experience thing that's just really beautiful.
I'm curious to know, because I think when, as British Asians, and I've spoken about this with actors in the black community, I feel like, obviously, if we're talking from a pyramid perspective, you've got sort of white people at the top where the majority of the roles are.
Yeah.
Then the Black community are a sort of second, and I feel like we're coming in slowly a third.
Yeah.
Do you feel a sense of competitiveness with other Asian actors you're going up against purely because the pool is so small?
A little bit, yeah, a little bit, but less so, in a really good way. I feel like when I first started out, there was a real, like, blinkers on, stay focused, there's only one cool Asian part that comes around every year or whatever, and I think that's changing. And I also think that we're all so different. Whenever you lose a job, speaking from my own experience, it will often be to someone who's a totally different, like, choice and is making totally different choices and just brings different energy naturally. That it's not, I don't think, like, we can outdo each other through will and determination. And not, we shouldn't be doing that either. Like, I think the more we connect and the more we talk about the things that we like and the things that don't work, and I don't know, sometimes I received a script for something that I just felt was not right. It shouldn't be being told from the perspective it was being told from. And I met other actors who felt the same. And when you can talk about that with other people, you can also sort of go, yeah, I don't think I'm going to go in for it, actually. Yeah, I don't think I will either. In fact, I might speak to my agent about how I feel about it and how it represents a certain community. Yeah, I might do the same. And I think there's something so beautiful in us joining together and celebrating each other's work. I think we become more of a force, and more opportunities come out that way. I really believe that.
When do you feel like that change happened for you? Because I know I've noticed, especially on social media recently, you know, you're really great with spending time with other actors, and I've seen some really cool photos and things like that, and that unity is so inspiring, and I imagine for different actors it makes them feel like, yeah, I don't need to feel like I'm pitted against them all the time, and actually we can be friends.
To be totally honest, I think I was really inspired by some of my friends from the Black community, who I just feel like they really champion each other wholeheartedly, and I think that's such a beautiful thing. And yeah, I just was like, I'd want to start doing that. And I think you sometimes you can't be like, hey, guys, let's all group together. Let's all start doing this thing. You just have to do it and hope that it makes other people do it a little bit. It's got to be the reason behind you guys starting this podcast.
It's so funny, right? Hearing you say that, because this podcast idea started from Saga saying, I'm not even joking, pretty much word for word what you've just said.
Isn't it amazing that we all
when
feel
we're
it?
On set in Good Karma. Yeah, we feel it, and then nobody really speaks about it. And I was, you know, similarly to you, not really aware of how many British Asians there are in the industry. And we're both fair, so you do go up for the white roles as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially now when boxes are being ticked and you go in because they probably need to see you.
Yeah. yeah.
And then you get the job because you're just so damn good.
Yeah.
But I think the first time I became really aware of, I suppose, the limitations of casting and kind of like what you were saying about there's one role or two, a couple of roles that come around every year that are really good, or more to the point, the problematic side of some of the roles that you do go up for and then you feel like you have to go up for it. But actually, as a collective voice, when you start talking to people that feel the same way and you're like, oh my God, I'm not the only one.
Yeah,
that was really interesting. So yeah, this is kind of everything you just said.
Is the idea
said to me,
it.
And then I was like, well, why don't we just make a platform where we do celebrate that? If we're not going to do it as a party, let's record it and put it out.
That's
there.
That's brilliant. It says to me that, like, social joy and you like uniting and having a common goal rather than an individual one must be somewhere an innate quality that we've picked up on, that we're all slowly starting to wake up to it. I don't know.
Yeah.
I feel like,
and I think like the more opportunities there are and the more people talk about it, the less fear there is of, I don't know, almost kind of going, oh, there's only that one role and I have to just stay focused on that. And
yeah,
you know, I think it translates across a lot of different industries though. I don't think it's just
Which actually takes me back quickly before I forget, with the writing that you did and the wonderful short that happened, came on during lockdown. Remind me what it was called?
People Under the Moon.
People Under the Moon, that was it. No, I thought it was fantastic. And what was the actor's name? Because he was great.
Gwilym Lee.
Really good.
So
really
good.
Really fantastic.
Yeah.
What I was going to ask you is, did you feel pressure as a writer to write something that was a South Asian character?
No, I didn't. No, I didn't at all. Sash and I went to see this thing, and I've forgotten the name of it. It's this great charity that just gives young people at school, I think they're like 5 to 8 or something, an opportunity to write a piece that real actors perform. I've forgotten the name of the charity. I think it's like Seen and Heard. And so we went along to watch it to support one of our friends, and the pieces that we loved the most were written by two Muslim kids, and we know they're Muslim because there were two girls who wore a hijab, and the pieces weren't about being South Asian at all. One was about an ice cream and I think memory, but I think it was candy floss on a different planet and the war that they have. And it was just like so wow. bold and interesting and genuinely really funny and entertaining. Such a great story arc from a five-year-old, but it was nothing to do with their race, nothing to do with how they saw themselves. I just thought that was so inspiring, because often we do get asked to bring people just assume that we have, I'd assume where we come from or assume what we feel about that place, or that we'd want to tell stories just about that place. I think it's important for us to tell stories about that, but it's also beautiful that we get to just tell stories about
weather. I think it is, but I think I've spoken to a couple of writers of ethnicity and of colour who've sort of felt like it just kind of falls to them to write about the hardships or the problematics of being a certain race, or, you know, the issues that come with it, and that's what they're commissioned to write, or that's what they'll feel like they need to write. But actually there's a hell of a lot of other stories that they'd prefer to write and tell about, but
that's
almost like, okay, but these are the only ones that want to be heard by the people that do publish them or put them out.
Yeah.
And I wonder whether that is a little bit of a similar case when it comes to getting more writers of colour heard, is that, well, that's great, but if you're only being commissioned to write about race, then those are the only stories that will ever come out and be heard. And actually there's such a different side to everybody, that where race is incidental, I guess. And
yes,
I don't know how you feel about the roles that come your way, whether you feel really aware of that when you make choices.
A little bit. I feel like this is something I changed my mind about a lot. I quite like the idea that race is incidental, and I quite liked keeping my name if they've written the character with the name. The character I just played was called Tiffany, and I didn't ask to change it because I thought the name suited the character really well. And just, yeah, there wasn't that awkward conversation of like, should we call her something quite ethnic now that you've been cast? But I do sometimes think it's important to, that my other half of my head comes in and I go, I think it is important to meet characters who don't look like they just accidentally cast an Asian actor for a white part. And actually we do bring a bit of race in, and we do hear that their name is Indian. And so the world, people that, like the kids at the Forces school I went to who haven't experienced people from different racial backgrounds, suddenly are seeing people who have a name that's from a certain country and might dress a certain way, or, I don't know, have something about their character that is Indian. Mm-hmm. And it just exposes people to the differences in the world a bit.
I know when just family of mine would see a TV show or a film and there is an Asian protagonist, South Asian protagonist, you know, there is something where they go, oh yeah, their name's that, and therefore that means they're probably from that community, because they'll clock the surname.
Totally.
And they'll just go on a tangent.
100%.
And it's amazing, because you do that within family or friends, but now that you can do it based on what you're seeing on film and TV, there's something so prideful about that.
Yeah, that's, you know? It. I think I really want to, like... Where, I don't know, I'm an actor, not like an activist, but sometimes I go that way a little bit. But it'd just be great to have boundaries, like barriers pulled down between people, for us to, like, I don't know, start to relate to each other that bit more. And I think when you do imbue a character with a racial identity, I think they're just that facilitates that sort of unity a little bit more.
Yeah. I would love to explore, if it's okay with you, just a bit around the anxiety and depression that you spoke about.
Yeah.
And just sort of how it affects you. Is it something that comes and goes? Is it something quite regular for you? Or how would you describe it? I'm
so
sort of saying
weird.
It in such a general way. It may be specific for you.
How does it affect me? I think both anxiety and depression for me were just like processes that I'd learnt. It's just bad internal talk. I think I just really beat myself up a lot and put a lot of pressure on myself. And put a lot of pressure on things that I have no control over, which is kind of a bit of a bad breeding ground for an actor. So I think, like, for me, it's been unlearning bad behavioural patterns and trying to replace them with really positive ones. And I feel like I'm on top of that. I feel like I'm in a happier place with that. And I definitely fall off the bandwagon sometimes. You don't get a job that you wanted, or you haven't heard back, or what happens sometimes with us is, like, you get told by a really passionate, enthusiastic director or producer that, like, they really like you and this job's going to be yours, but then it just disappears. You don't hear anything ever again. And so sometimes I'll fall back into, like, do berating myself or trying to analyze or trying to like take apart the interview audition or the communication and go, what went wrong? What could I control there? And that's how it manifests, the sort of bad self-talk. And then I sort of try to reverse that and do this thing called taking the thought to court, which is this thing I picked up, which is you have a little courtroom in your head and you present the thing, which is like, I said something that made them dislike me. And then you present it in your mind with like a for and against. And quite often you can just completely take this thing out of it because you're like, yeah, there's actually no evidence for that. So I think the jury have decided that that is a not guilty verdict. And I didn't say anything that like it's
that's amazing.
And it's quite a funny thing to do. And the more you do it, the less you actually have to physically go through the your brain just automatically goes, there is no evidence for that. I'm just doing the work of the devil there, telling myself a bad story about something that didn't happen. I'm just not going to do that.
So are you quite good at dealing with it on your own?
Yeah, okay. I think so. Yeah. And having great friends as well. And realizing that actually, I think most people I know, I'd say all but maybe one, have similar struggles. Some know that that's what they struggle with because they've, I don't know, spoken to health professionals about it, and some don't, but they kind of think that that might be what's going on. I think both anxiety and depression, I think, are so prevalent in the world today. I really do believe that, exacerbated by social media. And I think some of us are really good at handling it and some of us need a bit more help.
I remember, God, it must be over a year ago. I think you put up an Instagram post or maybe...
God, you're so good with like your knowledge.
With, I think
I... Dozens of research.
You really do.
I think you did a video to camera talking about it.
Yeah.
And I remember that stuck with me because I was like, wow, that's so brave and courageous. And what made you want to do that? Am I right, timeline-wise?
You are, yeah, you're right. It was kind of the end of 2017. I don't know. I think it was just like having an epiphany and being like, oh my God, what I have is this thing. And I it's a thing that I can do something about, and I bet loads of people have it and don't know that it's a thing that they can do something about, and that other people feel it too. I think I must have nicked the idea or been inspired by somebody else coming forward on social media or like an Instagram story and just being like, oh my God, I don't judge that person at all. I think it's so commendable and I've respect them tenfold. Like Chrissy Teigen is a prime example of someone who I think goes but like bold and barefaced with her struggles. And I think really recently, if one person walks away and feels like they're seen and feels like there is help out there and that they're not alone, that's enough. That's a great thing, I think.
Did you have any worries putting it up that maybe, because I know especially for men, there's the fear of
stigma.
Looking weak,
yeah,
and the stigma attached to that maybe doesn't exist as much for females, but you know, did you ever worry about any sort of not backlash, but just like, oh, I may come across this way and I want to come across this way?
A bit, yeah, a bit, definitely. Yeah, I don't know. I think a bit, and also as an actor, you want to kind of appear to be neutral. You don't want to suddenly not get a comedy gig because everyone's like, oh God, she's a bit dark and deep. But I going back to the percentages thing, I think like the joy from or the hope that somebody will watch that and feel a tiny bit better, I think outweighs. I think sometimes because of what we do and because we have a following, I think with that, I personally feel like I give myself a little bit of responsibility to be the role model to people that I wish I maybe had growing up. So that kind of kicks in on the doubt a little bit. But yeah, it's weird. It's a scary thing, isn't it?
It is. And when it comes to sort of depression and anxiety, sort of on just being an Asian level, I find a lot of people that I know who are British Asian or people of colour really struggle to talk about. It's like it's not really a thing that you talk about in your family or that's okay to talk about in your family. And, you know, and I think that's slowly being broken. Those walls are being broken down by a generation, but there's almost an anxiety attached to the anxiety of breaking that wall down. And
it's
dealing
so
with,
funny,
okay,
yeah,
like I really want to talk about this, but I'm really anxious about talking about anxiety. Because I think there was a lot of people struggle with it and yet don't talk about it or aren't willing to sort of, I guess, come forward with it. It's almost like an admission of, like you touched on, weakness. You know, whether you're male or female, I think. I'm just curious as to sort of how you... I've managed to flip that on its head and make it, no, you can deal with this thing and it's normalize it, I guess.
Yeah, I wonder if it's like the perfection perfectionist that in me that goes, there's something here that is less than perfect, and I want to be able to do something about it. Maybe it comes from the putting pressure on myself. I don't know. I know what you mean, though. Sometimes you can sit with something and not quite even know that it's a problem. Yeah, I don't know where that comes from. It must be from, I think we're all products of our environment. So I think there isn't any doubt in my mind. I feel like we're all talking about mental health more than we ever, ever, ever have done. And realizing how much it impacts our physical bodies and the role that mental health plays in a lot of autoimmune diseases as well, is like your physical manifestation of your mental anxieties. So I think it's just, it's one of those things that I'm like, it's the elephant in the room that wouldn't be there if we all just went, this is the thing, like we do RE, we do maths, and then we do mental health at school. I don't know. It's something that we could all fix quite quickly. I really, truly believe that we all have our demons, but we don't know that other people have them. But if we all knew that we all had them, we'd be able to deal with them a bit better.
Is that a subject matter you think you'd want to explore through your writing as well?
I think so, yeah.
You just seem very sort of like... I just love the idea of this courtroom. I was like, oh, she should write about that. She should make it into a scene.
Oh, yeah, maybe. That sounds
great
cool.
Way to deal with it. I'm still thinking
really
about
good,
it.
It's really good,
isn't
it?
Yeah, I think it's a really...
What is it? That technique has a name, doesn't it?
Take the thought to court.
That's the actual name of it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's great. It's really funny. Yeah.
But it's great for analytical people as well. Isn't
yeah.
It? If you're into dissecting and getting to the root of it.
I think Amrita touched on it before, but I'd love to know who some of your role models were when you were early on in your career. Even now, who do you sort of look up to? Who are your... It doesn't even have to be actors. There's people you sort of use as inspiration.
That's really interesting, because I have like actor role models. Maya Angelou. I think it's Angelou, or is it Angelo? She's just phenomenal. Her story, if you don't know it already, like you probably do, but look it up, like what she went through as a child, is just like, for me, it was a turning point in learning about her and that, because it's like all the bad stuff that happens to you can become your superpower a little bit. That's her sort of narrative. And she says this amazing thing about taking the people that she's lost with her everywhere. So when you go to an audition or an interview or anything where you're a little bit afraid or a little bit scared because you're like, oh my God, I just don't know how I'm going to come across and whether I'm going to be able to hold my shit together. She imagines that all of the people that have passed that she loves are with her, and she takes them with her. So when she goes to an audition or an interview, she doesn't audition, when she goes to an interview, they're all goes on stage, they're all just standing next to her, and they've all got her back. And I just think there's something like so powerful about that. And you see it in her eyes, like she feels greater than she is. She just has this presence, and yeah, and she owns it. And I think she went through a period of selective mutism because she just couldn't come to terms with what had happened to her, so she read every book that she could get her hands on. And so now she attributes everything that she knows, her poetry, her language, her love of all of that, on what happened to her. She's like, had that stuff not happened, I wouldn't be this profound poet and performer. And I just think that's an incredible life lesson, that like the stuff that we go through shapes us and can be, like I said before, can be a superpower. I don't know, that probably sounds really cheesy, but it's something that I just take everywhere with me.
Are there people you take into the room with you?
I'm going to start doing that, I think, definitely. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Who would you take?
Definitely my nanny Ma. God, her spirit is like, it's that thing, isn't it, where you really realise the impact someone has on you when you lose them. But she laughed through all of her grief and was just like this force that I think is everything I am is because of her, even though we didn't get to spend a lot of time together. But my mum is just like the carbon copy of that woman. So I think a lot of that, a lot of her ethos is ingrained in the way that I was raised. That relentless sort of just keep going, and keep laughing through the pain is something that I just think is just part of who I am. So yeah, she's going to come everywhere with me. I can't wait to take her.
Was she
to places.
Living in Nottingham? Was she up there?
No, she was in India.
Oh, she was in India.
An
okay.
area called Assam, which okay. is really, really hard to get to.
Whereabouts is it?
It's in the north, and it's bordered by Nepal and I think also China. I need to be better at my geography. But I think it was a bit of a tricky area for ages because each one of those countries, including India, wanted to take it on as part of their country, and it also wanted to become its own republic. So it just was very scary to get there. You need a separate visa to get there, so it's tricky. So we just didn't get to see her very often, but she did come and spend 6 months with us when I was about seven. Which I'm just so grateful we got to have.
Did she know you on the telly? Did she know you?
Yeah, I wish we had more time, man. I wish I could have like shared more of it with her. I always was like, no, there will be a part that I will have at some point that will be right up her street, and I'll go and watch it with her, and we'll just share that thing, because she knew how much I wanted to be an actress and how much I love performing. And it just, the right job never came. And that's why I think I've got to a point a little bit where it's like the job of my dreams might never happen. So I have to find other things that I love as much, or I'll make my own dream job, if that makes sense.
I know you've spoken about in the past about your mum sort of being, you and your mum are quite close, right?
Yeah, really close.
How was that sort of early on in terms of when you said that you were, you know, going to dabble into acting? Was there like support all the way? Was there some
100%? Yeah, 100%, definitely. My mum, I was like, I want to go into acting, and she's the one who found Television Workshop. And we were in Germany at the time, and she called the guy that ran it, Ian Smith, and was like, is there any way that she could, I know she can't physically attend the classes, we didn't have Zoom then and very crap internet, can she not just do it over the phone with you? Can she not, like, genuinely, my mum, there is like, impossible is genuinely nothing with my mum. She really thought there would be a way that I could remotely act.
Oh, that's really amazing.
Yeah, it didn't happen. Obviously, I had to wait till I came back and auditioned. Try and get in, but yeah, she really really wanted me to follow that.
Do you guys ever get people in your family who are not accustomed to the sort of etiquette of our industry? So I'll give you an example. I remember something was on Netflix, I can't remember what, and my mum goes, Saga, can't you just ring Netflix and see if they'll
oh my
put
god
you in the
100%
show? Ring Netflix. I don't even know how to. I wouldn't even know who to call. Like,
she probably would do it for you.
Yeah, probably. Just can you not just like ring Danny Boyle? Like, you could learn the guitar. No, Himesh is really good. I don't think I should have done
that.
Oh
my
god,
I love that.
So yeah, just like email. Can you not email Danny Boyle?
Yeah.
No, can't do that. Unfortunately,
it does make you think like how much our families have done to get to where they are.
Yeah.
And then there is so much of that in us, I think.
Yeah.
We probably won't be ringing Danny Boyle anytime soon, but, you know.
Be a nice number to have on speed dial, but unfortunately not for me.
You're listening, Danny.
No, it's just fascinating. You're right. I think it sort of comes from that immigrant work ethic.
Yeah, that's
where it. There is no. We'll find a way through if there's a way to find a way through. And it sounds like you had that support around you, which is so fantastic to have.
Yeah, I'm really, really lucky.
Did you, did it feel then slightly different when you moved to London? Did you feel disconnected from it?
A bit, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, London's weird at first, isn't it? When you come, I didn't come for drama school and I didn't come for a job. I worked in a bar for, and that's basically where I met all my friends who just weren't in the industry at all. And that was hard in itself because I couldn't relate to them about acting. They were just like really excited by it all, and they were like, oh, you're in a children's TV show, that's so cool, like you've made it. And it's quite hard to be like, and sometimes I very rarely would get the odd punter in who was now of age who'd be like, weren't you that kid from Sarah Jane Adventures? And they'd sort of like, even though you're so young, because I was like 21 when I moved here, they were like, oh, did it not work out for you then? You're like, oh no, I think I have time.
Yeah. Is that what brought you to London then, Sarah Jane? Or was that shot up north?
It was shot in Wales.
Oh, shot in Wales. Okay.
No, I came just because I wanted to be around it. I wanted to be able to see a lot more theatre. I wanted to just be London-based. And I guess because I didn't go to uni and I didn't get to do the whole like freshers and living away from home, that kind of became that for me.
Were you in a house share? Did you have a place? Where were you? How was that experience early on?
I lived in a flat with two other people who, again, weren't involved in the industry at all.
Which is probably lovely, actually.
It was, actually. I don't know about you guys, but I love meeting people that don't do what we do. Because it's just really interesting to know about real life.
And, yeah.
To not be in an echo chamber of like, God, it's so shit at the moment, isn't it? Or like, oh, God, agents, blah, blah. Though I do often have those conversations. I live with an actor, so we talk about all of that a lot.
Yeah, I sort of, I feel like having non-actor friends completely keeps you grounded.
That's exactly it.
It just makes you feel like there is a bigger, wider world out there, and you'll worry about not getting that audition or that person keeps getting all the roles.
Yeah.
Just puts it into perspective.
Yes.
Because people are having some like real issues out there. And yeah, I think it completely keeps you grounded.
I just, because we've been talking about identity and you mentioned coming to London, I was wondering whether that had anything to say in terms of you sort of owning your heritage and where you're from, purely because London is so much more multicultural. Was there a difference from up north to down here, down in London?
In terms of the
journey of sort of, I suppose, reconnecting with your roots and being proud of where you're from rather than trying to fit in somewhere else.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? Like in Nottingham, if you saw an Indian person, South Asian person, on a bus or a train or anywhere in town and you didn't know them, you'd sort of give a little look of like, cool, yeah, nice to see a fellow Asian person. But in London, like I tried to do that on the tube, tried to be like, oh, hi. Like, and people just look at you like, what? Have I got something on my face? Or like, is there someone behind me? Or what do you want? That was a bit strange. But I found myself like really yearning for contact with like older South Asian people. So I like met a guy called Chima who ran the off license at the end of my road and would go in and just chat to him and just like have a little samosa that he'd made and sold. And I think he was just quite pleased to have like a young Asian person to like regale with all of his stories of childhood. But then I went away for a bit to do a play and I came back again and met my now boyfriend and was like, oh, come in and meet my mate Chima, and went into the newsagents. And I think Chima was just having a really bad day that day. And and also it had been 9 months, so I think he'd totally forgotten who I was. And our connection felt greater to me maybe than it did to him. And I was like, meet Sasha. And he was like, sorry, who are you? And I was like, aw. When I came back a few days later, he totally recognised me, but it just, I think a delivery had gone awry or something.
What was Sasha's response?
He was just a bit like, I don't think he knows you, this is not cool. Like, why are you being so weird?
That's brilliant.
I know you're saying that living with an actor, a lot of the talk obviously can be centred around acting or the industry or whatever. And you mentioned over lockdown, you guys sort of made a conscious effort to be in the room together. And how do you, not that there's anything wrong with those conversations, but how do you steer away from your home life just becoming work and work focused and work chat? Have you got other stuff you do that you really enjoy, or like an outlet, I guess, is what I'm asking?
I think that's something that we're both like working on doing individually and also working on doing together, because it just does dominate everything. It really can. And so the writing for a while, like Sasha's also producing bits and pieces or would like to be producing bits and pieces. So he's sort of like creating projects that he can potentially do that with, that we then ended up talking about that loads, and that's what we started waxing lyrical about, and that took over all of our conversations. But we go for these big walks because London's great for like walks. There's just so many you can do and discover different areas, and turns out we both just really like it. So walking, and I've roped him into stuff, so we have a little mosaic tile set to make candle holders. And obviously with my productive brain, I'm like, great, these will be great Christmas presents. So I'm like, go free, go wild, use whatever colors you want, and it'll start doing that. And then I'm like, no, but that color doesn't really go with those colors, Sasha, so maybe like think about that. And I think he's like, will you just let me create? So I am a control freak, and I do just need to let him get on with it. But we are sort of enjoying making stuff together, but also I think I've got him getting a bit crafty on his own as well, which is nice to see.
I was actually going to ask you, because we were talking about you moving down to London. You mentioned you were working in a bar. What were some of the other odd jobs that you were doing?
I tutored maths for a little while. I think that was actually the main one. I was tutoring maths to this brilliant, brilliant girl who was self-sabotaging and reminded me of a younger version of me. When I first kind of met her, when I first met her mum, I was expecting, the way she described her daughter was that she was self-sabotaging and really didn't want to speak to anybody, wouldn't connect with anybody, lost. So the image in my mind was like a girl who was just quite meek and quiet and mousy. But what I met was basically me as a kid. She had tobacco all over the floor, a punch hole in her wardrobe, pen graffiti all over her bedroom wall. And I was just like, not that I necessarily had all those things going on for me, but there was like a sort of angry kid who, or like a streetwise kind of teenager who also happened to be really smart. And I was like, oh my God, I so understand this person. I know what she is. She's too cool to be clever. Like, she's got herself in a weird place at school. So we just chatted. And I think she had seen the Sarah Jane Adventures, which at first was a bit weird because she was like, I thought you was on telly. Like, she had attitude. And I was like, yeah, I am on telly sometimes. And also really like math. So let's talk about math.
So long division.
Yeah, basically. But we kind of made it, I made it fun and cool and became a bit of her older sister, which started to get a little bit scary, I'm not going to lie, because I was like, oh, I'm having quite an influence over you too. Like, because we would end up talking like outside of, like, I'd go for an hour or two to do tutoring, but I'd end up staying 45 minutes afterwards just to chat about how she was getting on. But we became mates, and it just got a little bit like she would ask me about who I was dating, and I would share stuff, and then you kind of go, but this isn't, I'm a teacher, I'm here to teach, like, I'm not your mate. And it became hard because we clearly had stuff in common. And I guess at 22, with her being 16, there's not like a huge age gap. Like, you sort of, I remember school because I wasn't there so long ago. But yeah, that actually became the subject of my play that I took to the court, which was just about the idea of, like, when you become a parent or you become a role model, like, no one takes you to school to do that. No one takes you through role model college and is like, oh, don't talk about those things or those things because you'll influence that person to do those things. I think I told her that I basically copied out the textbooks and then just memorised them like you memorise a script, so that when it came to the exams, I was just regurgitating information. When I then came to tutor her the next day, I found out she'd flunked off school to sit in a park with her physics book. And her mum was like, she took her bike today, didn't go to school to study leave school hours, and just went and sat in a park, and I don't believe it. I think she's probably gone to hang out with mates. And I was like, oh no, she totally has. She's done what I said. She's gone and copied her. But that became dangerous because I was like, I shouldn't have an influence over her behaviour that isn't productive in her mum's eyes.
Is mentoring something you see yourself
doing?
I'd
love to. Someone said something really interesting, because I was like, I don't have the answers. I don't know where this... I guess I feel like even after 12 years of doing it with an agent, I still don't know what the ways to survive are. We're all kind of figuring that out as we go along. Do you know Nikesh Patel? Mm-hmm. He said, and it's so great, he was saying that we become jaded somewhat by the limitations that have existed in our industry when we started, but that the industry can only evolve when people challenge that. So if we turn up on our next gig and go, I want half the crew to be ethnic minority, please, and it happens, the producer goes, yeah, we can I guess we could do that. We realise that there are changes that we can make. We do have power, but if we don't, I kind of skipped a part there. Because someone new to our industry, someone young, might be like, I don't get why we can't do this, and I don't get why we can't do that. And we, as people who have been doing it for a bit, will go, no, people won't go with that. They won't let you have a half Asian crew. That's not going to happen. But in meeting young people who have these big ideas, it reminds us that of the things that the limitations that we've started to put in our own heads based on experience. And he was talking about how Guz had asked about a similar thing on Man Like Mubeen, and that Nikesh was like, that's not going to happen. Actually, it did end up happening. And Nikesh was like, it's so sad that I assumed the naysayer position because I just didn't think it would ever come to fruition. So in meeting young people, we keep ourselves flexible. I think that's what...
Can that depend on your position on the show? Like us being
definitely
writer-creator?
In that thing, yeah, 100%. But like, for example, me and Sasha watched the Little Mix documentary the other day, where it's not a documentary, it's like a talent scouting thing, and an Indian guy came on, South Asian guy, and he was like doing the, like, you know, the Indian, like, I'm not going to do it, but where your voice sort of warbles a bit and your head shakes, yeah. And like, he was owning his ethnic identity so much, and I was just like, Jesus, I wish, I'm going to start doing more of that. I'm so like moved and inspired by it. But I feel like younger generations are more unashamed about who they are and where they come from, and they're proud about it. You often see the little flags in their, like, bios on Instagram of, like, what their country of origin or whatever. Mm. And I think that's what I'm saying. Like,
I think everybody probably has that. I don't know about how you feel about it, but I kind of feel like I think we were all born without limitations, and we all,
definitely,
as kids, I mean,
we learn.
You
them.
Sound like you had a massive imagination growing up as well, but you learn that there are roofs or there's a ceiling,
yeah,
and then you kind of either accept it or or fight it.
Yes.
And I don't know whether as actors or in the creative industry, so much has to be in place before you can have the power, or you feel like you can have a voice to say it.
Yeah.
But that kind of just shuts down any ideas in your head that you might have about, no, I can challenge that, and the world's not going to come to an end.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think we start, that's what I was saying, I guess, that we start to put limitations on ourselves the older we get. And when you meet someone who's a bit more uninhibited, it kind of cracks your...
This might be a bit, I don't know, it's just a question that I sometimes pose myself, and I don't know how you guys feel about this, but is it also us being a little bit lazy and
kind of 100%.
Going, rather than going, I just can't be bothered with the fight?
100%.
And actually, if everyone just fought a little bit more, maybe we could get a hell of a lot further.
I really believe that.
I think there's an element of fear of failure, fear of rejection,
yeah,
as you get older, because inevitably, as you get older, your ego grows slightly.
Yeah.
I think in our 20s and our teens, there's a sense of, you know, like you can take on the world,
yeah,
and no one can stop you. I know I certainly, in my 20s, I was
100
indestructible.
Were you?
I swear to God, I felt like no one could do anything to me. Or if I could, I could take it on the chin and keep it moving.
Yeah.
And then you sort of hit your late 20s and, you know, you hit that 30 mark and you kind of go, oh, maybe I'm not where I wanted to be. Maybe that's me.
Yeah.
And then the confidence drops off.
Yeah.
And it's not what it was when you were 21.
Yeah.
So then the example that you gave with Nikesh saying to Guz, you're not going to get that.
Yeah.
Is maybe an experience he experienced, or maybe, you know, just felt like, oh, I've sort of half tried that in the past and it didn't work, so it's not going to work for you.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm just guessing he may have not done that. But I think it's that fear of going, don't put yourself out there because
yes,
it's not going to happen.
Yeah, fear of rejection,
yeah,
fear of the fight.
Also dealing with the disappointment if it doesn't go your way.
100%.
Because I think we deal with so much disappointment anyway on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah. Yeah. Why add more?
You know, and I'm also like, I don't know whether anyone else does it, but I kind of go, I'm not going to hope too much. Because it's too much effort.
That's so bad, isn't it? We shouldn't
really
be
bad.
Not
because hoping is
enough.
Such a lovely,
so important.
Hoping and expectation, I think, is such a nice emotion to actually have.
Yeah.
Yes. But then you kind of go, oh, I can't
There's
feel
this
that
amazing
too much.
Book called The Big Leap, by a guy called Gay Hendricks, and he says that like it's basically a book about self sabotage, and there is a little bit in us all that like the last little 10% that would get us over the line and would get us the gig that we wanted or the crew that we wanted, we just step back from it and we allow self-sabotage to take over because we're afraid of what it might feel like to get to where it is we need to be. So when you said about being lazy, I wonder if like there's a little part of us that's like, no, because if I do fail, then that's something I'm a little bit more comfortable with. If I don't quite, like, we're already writing excuses into our, or like reasons to fail in the language that we use about, like, talking about, I don't know, like, when you email someone, you're like, I would really like this, but if it's not possible, it's not a problem. I totally understand. It's like,
I've started taking those out.
Yourself.
I now do a whole, how many words are not useful?
That's great.
What are those extra words? Take out the just.
That's
take
great.
Out so.
Like, I'm just. Is it that, like, that
yeah,
just?
I'm just. Because I often start emails by going, oh, hi, hope you had a great weekend. I'm just emailing to ask whether you might consider da-da-da-da. Whereas now I'll go, I'd like to do this thing. Do you want to be part of it? And the emails become so much shorter.
It's like you're apologizing for sending an email.
Yeah,
yes.
But then I don't know. There's just a sense of ownership that you get where you're not apologizing for having sent it almost, because it is and a very apologetic and slightly putting yourself under somebody.
Yes. Why do we do that?
I don't know. It's interesting because I think a lot of it's a very female thing to do as
it's
well.
It's so female. Yeah.
It's quite a female thing to do.
So I guess to sort of summarize this section is, what are some of the answers?
Summarize.
I love that. So I felt like we're writing a thesis together.
In summary, I guess it's great that we sort of talk about these things. What are some of the solutions that we can go forward with? Do we need to step up and put those questions out there? And if they get knocked back, they get knocked back?
Yeah, I think so. I think we have to be unafraid a little bit. I don't know. It's hard. This is the solution. We're already doing it in talking to each other.
Yeah.
Like, and realizing that we all kind of, there's something out there that we could still like aim for that we've not quite attained yet. I don't know, next time I'm in a position where someone says, why don't we do this? And the little voice in my head goes, nah, it's just too, like, probably not going to work. And why add that rejection to the list already? This will, I'll go, I know we had this chat. I know what I'm doing here. I'm self-sabotaging. No, yeah, I'm going to, let's do it. Let's absolutely have that fight. I don't know, maybe strength in numbers and bouncing this sort of stuff around.
I remember when Sasha was on, he was talking about that because he was on set somewhere and he mentioned that before he would, you know, you'd sort of rehearse the scene quickly. You go through lines on set with the director, you just read them. And then they'll go, okay, we're going to block it here, 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 and here. And Sasha was like, yeah, I've stopped letting them do that now. He goes, I'll go, no, if actually I think my character would start here.
Yeah.
And he was like, he goes, it's changed. Like, he goes, he loves doing that because it gives him that sense of, no, I'm making the decision here.
Yeah.
Instead of directing, okay, start here, then you're going to walk over there and then do this, da, da, da. And he goes, no.
It's actually amazing when you work with somebody who has confidence. And earlier this year, this time last year, I was working with Russell Tovey, who's been around for ages and knows Sasha obviously as well. And it was just a really small thing that he did, but I had quite a big emotional scene and we shot the shit out of that scene all, like, literally for 8 hours, which is fine. It's your job. You're getting paid for it.
Yeah.
But he did this thing where if it had been up to me, I'd have gone, whatever's easiest for you, just... You guys do. I'll just sit here and do my job. And he literally turned around and went, okay, so what should we just get them to do a close-up on you first so you've got that out of the way?
Oh.
And I'd never even considered I could kind of go,
ask for that.
Would you mind if we did my close-up first because then I've got that out of the way and I know I've got it in the can? But he literally did that. And as soon as he did that, that became the premise for the rest of the show, that whenever anybody had a difficult scene, the director would then step in and go, what do you want to do first?
That's great.
But it was amazing because talking of mentorship... Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Those are the little nuggets that nobody tells you at drama school if you went to drama school. Nobody tells you if you didn't go to drama school. Somebody that has worked has picked that up on the way.
Yeah.
And that's, if that's passed down and you were given a voice, you learn to own your voice a bit more.
100%. You know? I never thought about it like that. I suppose there is so much that we are picking up
on. It is. And
it's
kind of like what you were saying about identity as well. The more someone gives you a chance to hold your identity, to be a character with an Asian name, and an Asian family, and whatever that means to you or that character, you know, the more you can own it, the more of them there'll be.
Okay. Yeah, 100%. Yes, it inspires lots more to come out.
Yeah, but I think what you guys said about a collective voice, I mean, I think that's a massive thing because...
Well, actually, you know, you talked about Russell Tovey. Anjali, you've worked with some big hitters, Richard Madden, Mira Sayal, Rob Lowe. What were some of the experiences? Did you take away any nuggets from them?
Certainly Rob and Mira are very good at asking for what they need in a really polite and in a way that makes total sense. And people go, yeah, absolutely, of course. Yes, let's do that. That no brainer. And why didn't I think of that sooner? I guess it's the same thing. It inspires you to go, this isn't about me being a dick. I'm not asking for like extra pillows on my bed. I'm just asking for you to help me or for you to facilitate a good performance, which is why we're all here. And that then made me go, if I ever have a request, no matter how big it sounds, and it makes the work better, I'm going to ask because it's about the work and it's not about me. Unless it's something that would help me that no one else realizes might help me and like I have a unique request maybe. But yeah, watching them, I'm saying it like I've done it loads, but watching them ask for things made me go, yeah, I guess it's okay to do that. And I'm trying to like edge closer and closer to like being bold enough to go out and out on it and ask for things. I did it once. I did it with Doctor Who, which was quite scary because I had like a scene, I was playing the villain and there was like a massive showdown scene at the end. Where there's like a face-to-face sort of like villain meets all of the people she's been like terrorizing and is she going to succeed and scare them all and get what she needs. And it was actually the first scene that we shot and worked with an amazing director called Nida Manzoud. And I think the way that herself and the DOP thought the way that they wanted to shoot it and made total sense to shoot it was like a showdown that's like fixed. like me versus them. But I just, it felt like I wasn't, I had this like massive scorpion tail and huge like costume, but also it felt so important that I caught them off guard and caught them unawares. I've never felt so strongly about anything on set before, but I was like, I need to be able to move. I just know it. I just know that I won't give you what you need unless I can. And I would never normally ask. I was terrified. There was like Bradley Walsh, Jodie, Mandip, who I had not really, we'd spoken socially on social media, but we'd not met yet. Tosin and Robert Glenister, all actors I really look up to. And I'm the one who's got to make them really fucking scared. Like, Jesus, I'm shaking under this like metal costume. But being able to do that and like literally just come in their faces, come at them.
It's not that type of podcast, honestly.
My face then, like rubbing headlights, looking at you like, I've just said that thing.
It's staying in, by the way.
Oh, God. I hope you all enjoy it as much as we did. It just made it better anyway. And the scene unlocked itself for me and I got to do something that I felt really strongly about and that I hope I continue to be able to do. And because it was scary, I had to be like, I really see it like this. And Nida really made a case for why she saw it the way she saw it. But like it didn't become an ego conversation. It became like collaborative, like two artists trying to negotiate something. And I think that's, yeah, when it's worth doing.
And was it a case of you sort of bought your corner a bit more and she went, okay, or did you shoot both?
We rehearsed both.
Okay.
And I was like, can I just get it out of my system? Maybe I just need to get it out of my system. And I just do a version of it. And if you really hate it, like, and it really doesn't work, at least I know that I tried it. And so I tried it. And I think it made as much sense to do it that way as the other. So it worked out, thankfully.
We are running out of time, but I have a really important question around that. How important is a good number one?
So important, because it trickles down to everybody else, don't you guys think?
Yeah,
so important. Because I don't know about you guys, but I've been on a show where the number one's been a little nervous or a little bit like just so busy that they've tired and they've not been able to like just welcome in the people who are there for a lot shorter time periods. And I think it is nerve-wracking when you come in on a show when you feel like, oh, they're not comfortable, so I'm now not comfortable. Because things like speaking up for an actor or being like, that actor's been lying on a floor with no tights on for like 3 hours now. Can we just get them like a gym mat, or they're not even in shock? Could you just, like, those sorts of things can only really come from people in a slightly higher position. So I think it's really important to have someone that you don't have to be totally sociable and like, cause a lot of us are really nervous, but just being able to have people's backs a little bit, I think, is so important.
Yeah. For anyone listening, number one tends to be the person who is the star of the show, number one on the call sheet, so that they're very much top billing, just in case anyone's confused by that. We could talk to you for ages, but we're going to have to...
No, I can waffle
we
as well.
We have doubled our time.
Yeah.
I don't know how we're still in the studio. Do they still know we're here? We might be locked in.
We don't
in.
Have to tell.
Oh, great.
We're going to have to wrap that up, but our final question that we ask all our guests is, what is your favourite part of the process? Is it... the phone call, for example, as an actor, the phone call
oh
to say you got the job.
Yeah.
Is it the process and doing it, or is it the end product, whether that be on stage performing it or it's on telly and you see yourself?
The phone call definitely is up there at the top. And then I think when you've got your first scene out of the way, you've shot it, it's on camera, like you know they're not going to take it away from you. And also you've got the nerves out of the way and then you just get to play. I think those two... When it comes out, I'm terrified. I hate that bit. And I hate driving to set for the first day. That's just really scary and horrible. But the rest, yeah.
I don't think anyone's ever said the last one. I think everyone's
always
been
one or two.
Which is
really interesting. Yeah. It's, but I guess...
That's when it's
finessed. I guess it's
because
we have true
and...
artists on the show. That's probably why.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
It's just strange.
Anjali, my biggest takeaway from you today has been just to ask more of ourselves. So thank you.
Okay.
I think we can be a bit more demanding of ourselves.
Absolutely. On that note, Anjali, thank you for being a wonderful guest and being on the Rule Not the Exception podcast.
Oh, thank you for having me, guys.
Thanks.
You're awesome. Cheers.